Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Welcome back to The Critic Narrated, where we bring you a selection of articles from our print issues read aloud by their authors. In this episode, Robert Thickness narrates his Man About Town column from the December-January double issue, Welcome to Londongrad. Alexander Larman laments the myth of the Victorian Christmas for this issue's Sacred Cow. And in his architecture column, Charles Summeries Smith says that Jonathan Ruffer's daring philanthropic experiment with Auckland Castle hopes to bring a different kind of regeneration to the North East. First up, Robert Thickness reads Man About Town.
This is the Man About Town column from the December issue of The Critic by Robert Thickness. The Late Late Show. Now that London is roughly back to its dog-eared self, an old problem resurfaces. Even we votaries of the Muses need our downtime. The question has ever been where to disport oneself following the evening's official entertainment, the more so since one is usually in sore need of relief of one kind or another after the show. While this was never exactly the city that never sleeps, now even the sainted Joe Allen, haven of post-show depressives and dipsos for as long as anyone can remember, takes last booze orders at 11 p.m. thanks to the councillors of Westminster, rivals of the Mongol horde in their hatred of culture and entertainment. By the way, is there no pro-Genghis pressure group complaining about insults like these? Inspired by the ferociously disapproving Hogarth exhibition at the Tate, we have been working to revive the speakeasy culture that abounded in Covent Garden before it was full of imbeciles pretending to be statues. William Hickey writes approvingly of Weatherby's in Little Russell Street, where he catches his first topless ladies' cage fight before heading across the road at 3 a.m. to Murphy's, to continue in company with the accommodating blasted Bette Wilkinson and Pris Vincent, whose party trick was to hitch up her petticoats and manipulate her tu quoque so as to squirt her wine across a table into the neck of a bottle held on the other side. We've been trying to train more promising members of local chorus lines, but is this just one of those lost arts? Hello, Kitty. Still, don't the ladies who solaced everyone's existence so much deserve better monuments than those prim joints, last orders 10 p.m. for God's sake, named for their starry sisters Kitty Fisher and Cora Pearl? Kitty was well known to Hogarth, but her great moment is surely the Joshua Reynolds portrait as Cleopatra at Kenwood, where she dangles a pearl over her chalice of vinegar. Like one of those Renaissance pictures in which martyrs display their attributes, gridirons, flayed skin, all that, Kitty's finger and thumb elegantly form the shape of her tu quoque in a pithy advertorial. Kitty was no singer, but Cora, in Second Empire Paris, did take part in a revival of Jacques Offenbach's Orpheus in the Underworld in 1867, playing the role of Cupid and wearing a costume qui commence bien au-dessus du genou pour se terminer bien au-dessous de la poitrine et se prête dans l'intervalle aux explorations les plus audacieuses. One of the striking features of Corin's costume was that the soles of her boots were completely encrusted with diamonds. The performance appears to have been beneath contempt, but at least her breasts were described as beyond reproach. Latest vexed discussions among my colleagues in the Russian embassy revolve around the question of how to address the beloved Rodina's catastrophic decline, so astutely detailed by the latest MI6 sea creature, Richard Moore, earlier this year, noting that Russia is an objectively declining power and an extremely challenged place. As we nibble at zakuski of Baikal sturgeon, Siberian tiger's eye soup, the rest of the beast is inedible and fed to the embassy wolves. Bear black pudding and snow leopard pirozhki, ministered to by lovely secretaries in exiguous costumes made of that creature's fur, sipping wines chilled in Caucasus snow, lighting our exquisite jade Turkestan opium pipes with 1,000 petrol ruble notes, we ask ourselves, where, oh where, did it all go so wrong? Obviously, the best way to counter this awful slump is to assiduously copy everything Britain does, so brilliantly successful ever since George Osborne's days as Chancellor. We try to patch Vovic in on the hologrammatic plasma reaffection interface, coincidentally also known as Vovic, our primitive version of your fabulous Zoom, but it turns out he's indisposed, having one of his regular blood swaps with a 16-year-old Belarusian virgin. Why did we not see all this earlier? Fools! We moved to the subterranean banya, hotter than hell, where the secretaries mercilessly chastise us with birch vienniki. Of course, we should have sold our entire infrastructure to foreign serf states, as George did, outsourced the education system to Taliban and Boko Haram, banged out the whole of Londongrad's choicest real estate cheap to... Nonetheless, we do promise to respect Her Majesty's life tenancy of Buckingham Palace. And SIS has certainly got the jump on us, with Moore hanging in his office a portrait of... But no, let us spare his blushes. A foreigner who chose for moral reasons to turn against his own country and spy for Britain. We discuss how to reciprocate this lovely, if misguided, the chap was all ours all along, Sir Versondier, gesture. Who has undermined Britain to our greatest advantage? We go through the list. In the end, we decide on a picture of the entire UK cabinet, fixing beneath it a marvellous quote from the boss of MI5, a heartfelt citation for deliberate, targeted, malign activity intended to undermine free, open, and democratic societies. One joy for the epicure student of English sport is found in locating the precise moment the lack of two brain cells becomes apparent, with diverting consequences. Latest paragons are London club Wasps, who thought to gain an unfair advantage over upcoming rivals Exeter by denouncing the West Country club's supporters to the Race Hate Unit for their fans' amusing habit of wearing red Indian headdresses. Imagine the scene as some lunk named Ollie came up with the ruse at a strategy meeting involving charging repeatedly into a brick wall. Picture the ribaldry and merriment. Alas, within minutes, a furious storm arose among actual Wasps, complaining bitterly about this appropriation of their identity by these lumbering oafs in hoop shirts. More like fat bastard bumblebees, if you ask me, said one irate Vespid. I wonder how it will end. It seems very unwise to make enemies of these pungent guided missiles. Incidentally, Exeter's braves whopped Wasps' stripy asses with their rather fetching embroidered moccasins.
Next up, Alexander Larman says that our values today are of consumerism and instant gratification, inherited from our Victorian ancestors.
Sacred Cows, The Myth of a Victorian Christmas by Alexander Larman. When you think of Christmas, you think of a Victorian era and of Dickens. Only the most hard-hearted of skinflints could resist his evocation of a festive period, which has been emulated and ripped off ever since A Christmas Carol was first published. Has Ebenezer Scrooge from A Ghost of Christmas Present wander the streets of London? The descriptions mirror what Dickens himself had seen on his wanderings about the city the previous year, albeit with a little creative exaggeration. The author described the brightness of the shops, where holly sprigs and berries crackled in the lamp heat of the windows, made pale faces ruddy as they passed, and called it a glorious pageant, with which it was next to impossible to believe such dull principles as bargain and sale had anything to do. He then inadvertently created a multi-billion pound industry with his paean to the commercial festive season. The fruiterers were radiant in their glory. There were great round pot-bellied baskets of chestnuts, shaped like the waistcoats of jolly old gentlemen, lolling at the doors and tumbling out into the street in their apoplectic opulence. There were ruddy, brown-faced, broad-girthed Spanish onions, shining in the fatness of their growth like Spanish friars, and winking from their shelves in wanton slyness at the girls as they went by, and glanced demurely at the hung-up mistletoe. There were pears and apples, clustered high in blooming pyramids. There were bunches of grapes, made in the shopkeeper's benevolence to dangle from conspicuous hooks, that people's mouths might water gratis as they passed. There were piles of filberts, mossy and brown, recalling in their fragrance ancient walks around the woods. and pleasant shufflings, ankle deep through withered leaves. There were Norfolk biffins, squab and swarthy, setting off the yellow of the oranges and lemons. Dull of heart would he or she be who could read such a description and not be enraptured by Dickens' skill. All that is missing is a chorus of God rest ye, merry gentlemen. Itself a corruption of the original's God rest ye merry, gentlemen, a small but telling difference, and the sound of urchin children running about laughing and joking, securing the knowledge that the orphanage will be serving up a lavish feast for the unfortunate boys and girls in its care, courtesy of some twinkly-eyed benefactor. It is a seductive, evocative fable, and unfortunately almost entirely false in its suggestions and blandishments, a reminder that Dickens' imaginative powers remain considerably greater than his social commentary. To have celebrated Christmas in the early Victorian era was to participate in a series of innovations, as the season resumed its popularity after having fallen into abeyance in the Georgian period. The Christmas card was invented in 1843 by Sir Henry Cole, the first director of the V&A, who commissioned 1,000 of them, both for private use and public sale. Christmas trees, hitherto the preserve of aristocratic and court circles, after Queen Charlotte introduced them at court in 1800, became middle-class accessories. Dickens' evocation of snow-coloured festive scenes in both A Christmas Carol and his earlier novel, The Pickwick Papers, became the norm when it came to artistic and literary inspiration. This is the festive fantasy that we still celebrate today, and its marketability has served an entire industry extremely well. Yet the sanitised and largely anodyne forms that it takes today bear as little invention to reality as they did when Dickens, a struggling writer in need of a hit, commercialised a predominantly religious occasion and turned it into an orgy of extravagance. Even as he is today memorialised as the writer who invented Christmas, this is a willful misreading of historical fact that merely testifies to the success of Dickens' self-created PR machine. The Christmas festival had centuries of life in it before the Victorians commercialised it. The first existing carol is dated to 129 AD, the so-called Angel's Hymn. And by the 16th century, there was a canon of sacred music that was a world away from the rum-tum-tugger exuberance of the Victorian sing-alongs. And the discontent and outrage that accompanied Parliamentary Puritans' peremptory cancellation of Christmas celebrations during the Civil War and Protectorate would hardly have been so widespread if the festive period had been low-key. In fact, accounts of Tudor celebrations of Christmas make even Dickens' imagination look relatively barren. Many of the best-known carols that are still sung today, including We Wish You a Merry Christmas and While Shepherds Watch Their Flocks by Night, date from the period. The festival was kept for full 12 days with great pomp and pageantry. It was a time of social topsy-turviness, when a lord of misrule would be elected as a mock king to preside over good-natured ceremonies of feasting, drinking and cross-dressing, how very on-trend, and where lords and commoners were allowed to mix on more or less equal terms for the only time that year. And great care would be taken over provision for the poor, too. The final great feast on Twelfth Night, January the 6th, was a deliberately vast amount of food served, far more than could be eaten by the great men and women, so that the impoverished could be fed decently in the cold months of winter. Provision of the Victorian era at Christmas for the less well-to-do was sketchier. Those unfortunate enough to be incarcerated in the workhouse or orphanage, Christmas Day brought only another round of misery, mildly leavened by what little philanthropy some well-heeled individuals chose to bestow on the charitable project of choice. This was often resented. The journalist George R. Sims wrote a savage attack titled Christmas in the Workhouse, in which he castigated the wealthy who have come in their furs and wrappers to watch the poor eat. He observed their pleasure is to smile and be condescending, put pudding on paper plates, to be hosts of a workhouse banquet they've paid for at the rates. We have at least moved beyond this open condescension in society. But we may wish that the more joyful, almost anarchic spirit of Christmas that Tudor England celebrated could once again find traction in our ceaselessly divided and fractured society. And it really did seem for best part of a fortnight that peace on earth and goodwill to all men could exist. Alas, our values now are those of consumerism and instant gratification, as we learned from our Victorian forebears. So when you're munching on your overcooked turkey and downing your umpteenth glass of Baileys, wearing a hideous paper crown this Christmas, try to restrain yourself from toasting. God bless us, everyone.
And finally, Charles Samaras Smith narrates his architecture column.
Spanish Prize. Bishop Auckland, a small market town about 10 miles southwest of Durham, in the heart of what was until recently mining country, is the site of a fascinating experiment in urban regeneration, financed not by the state, but a private individual. The story began in 2001 when the church commissioners decided to sell a wonderful series of paintings of Jacob and his 12 sons by Francisco de Thurbrun. They were acquired by Bishop Trevor in 1757 for Auckland Castle, his palace at Bishop Auckland. Bishop Trevor was a worldly figure who wintered at his family estate in Sussex, added a Gothic gatehouse to the castle, created a new dining room to contain the Thurbruns, and is commemorated in the castle's chapel in a great tomb by Nollekens. The church commissioners took the view that these works of art were assets which should be sold for the benefit of the church. After lengthy negotiations and the offer of the paintings for sale to a billionaire who was encouraged to think they might look good in his dining room, Jonathan Ruffer, a very successful but low-key investment manager, who was mildly scandalised that such works of art might end up unseen, was encouraged to buy them himself. The church commissioners decided to throw in the castle as well to save on maintenance, provided that the bishop could keep an office on site. So Ruffer, who comes from the northeast, found himself without particularly intending to, as the proud owner of a run-down Episcopal palace and a seriously great but relatively unknown set of Spanish paintings, which were not by themselves a serious tourist draw. What was he to do? Unlike many very wealthy people, Ruff and his wife were stimulated by the challenge of how to bring jobs and investment to a relatively small and depressed urban community, which had been very hard hit by the closure of the pits. He wanted to bring money to the northeast, but also a sense of high culture and ambition. Ruff has renovated the castle, which is now open to the public. Its grounds are also open as a park. They've been used to create a big amphitheatre where a live performance about the history of Britain is staged during the summer, attracting huge local audiences. In addition, he bought a Gothic Revival house in the Market Square to establish a mining art gallery to show the work of local artists who documented life in the mines. And he commissioned Neil McLaughlin, an Irish architect who has developed an interesting career as a not-quite-revivalist, to design a structure which looks like a medieval siege tower to welcome people into the town. McLaughlin is also responsible for a big, monolithic building as one enters the castle grounds. This is going to be a faith museum. This October, Ruffer also opened a new gallery of Spanish art, which has been created out of a Franco-Gothic bank, again in the town square, by the architects Field and Clegg Bradley Studios. It's a spectacularly ambitious, high-minded venture, which the ground floor and two floors above are devoted to 17th century Spanish art, mainly drawn from Ruffer's own private collection, but including a big, much-restored painting of Philip IV hunting wild boar from the National Gallery, several paintings from the Hispanic Society of America, and some earlier religious sculptures. The top floor, previously an attic, has been converted by the architect Charlotte Skeen Catling to display an astonishing assembly of replicas of Spanish works of art, which have been digitally reproduced from their original setting by Factum Foundation, the charitable arm of a fabrication company in Madrid. It's a pure reinvention of the idea of the Victorian Albert Museum's cast corps. If you can't get to see the works in Spain, you can copy them in order to educate the public about the character and qualities of Spanish art. It's not clear what people will make of this juxtaposition of original and reproduction, but the intention with both is intelligently didactic. These are works of art which it would be hard to see even in Spain. The patronage is remarkable, but the popular verdict is not yet in. I would expect the local community to be more than a touch suspicious of the immensely high-minded generosity of a London-based international financier. But the North East has grappled with, for a generation at least, the difficult problem of what to do to regenerate those communities scarred by the closure of the mines from the 1960s to the 1980s. This feels like a project which has been undertaken with a great sense of determination to enhance the educational opportunities of the area, to give access to high culture, but also to self-consciously enjoy it too. The Gallery of Spanish Art will shortly be joined by restaurants and a boutique hotel. There will be places to eat in the market square. The palace's huge kitchen garden is being replanted. Rafa's stewardship of Auckland Castle and its treasures feels a much more committed form of social experiment and mild social engineering than merely opening freeports. Much of what is talked about as levelling up by the government seems to consist of a vaguely patronising view of relocating investment to the north. But this is a radical experiment whose philanthropic gifts encompass a belief in the possibility of salvation for people, things and places.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.